world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. Hi, my name is Janine Minio, born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. My Robert and I are longtime members of the King's Chapel, where he serves as elder and where we were married 32 years ago. I am mom to 5 adult children, mother-in-law to 1, and Nini to 2 grandchildren. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. The UN Atomic Agency warns that Iran is getting closer to a nuclear bomb. The Biden administration wants to make a deal.
That's ahead on Washington Wednesday. Also today, World Tour, plus keeping an old tradition ringing.
They're very big bells in the town hall, and that depth of sound was just magical.
And world founder Joel Bells uncovering more than the who, what, where, when, and why of the news.
It's Wednesday, March 23rd. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Paul Butler. Good morning.
Time now for the news with Kent Covington.
President Biden is traveling to Europe today to take part in an emergency meeting of NATO and address the European Council summit as Russia continues to pound Ukraine. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters at the White House,
he will have the opportunity to coordinate on the next phase of military assistance to Ukraine. He will join our partners in imposing further sanctions on Russia and tightening the existing sanctions to crack down on evasion.
European Parliament President Roberta Metsola met with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz on Tuesday about further tightening the screws on Russia. She said the EU has acted boldly, adopting unprecedented and massive sanctions.
But we can still do more. Europe must show Putin and his oligarchs that this war will come at the largest cost imaginable.
Biden will also travel to Poland this week, which is now ground zero for a worsening refugee crisis. Andreas Kirchhoff is spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency. He explained that more than 3.5 million Ukrainians have fled to neighboring countries so far, and that more than half of them, 2.1 million, are now in Poland.
And that means there's an enormous strain on the country. The arrivals each day is the equivalent of the inhabitants of a mid-sized town.
Polish President Andrzej Duda is asking for more U.S. aid and a stepped-up military presence on NATO's eastern flank. And on Tuesday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an end to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. He said there can be no winner in this war, and he added that he has seen progress toward negotiating a ceasefire. Guterres said he believes there is, quote, enough on the table to cease hostilities now.
Continuing the war in Ukraine is morally unacceptable, politically indefensible, and militarily nonsensical.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he is prepared to discuss a commitment from Ukraine not to seek NATO membership, that is, if Russian troops withdraw and guarantee Ukraine's security. He also repeated his call for direct talks with Russian strongman Vladimir Putin. That has not happened yet, but French President Emmanuel Macron on Tuesday talked with both Putin and Zelensky about the terms of a potential ceasefire. Macron said they reached no agreement, but he will continue diplomatic efforts. President Biden is urging U.S. companies to step up their cybersecurity due to potential Russian threats. He pointed to new intelligence that Russia is thinking about launching cyber attacks against critical infrastructure targets in the United States. The president told business leaders this week,
the federal government is doing its part to get ready. But under U.S. law, as you all remember, the private sector, all of you, largely decides the protections that is you will or will not take.
The president warned, quoting here, the magnitude of Russia's cyber capability is fairly consequential and it's coming. He added that the federal government is offering cybersecurity help to private companies if they want it. Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson is back in the hot seat on Capitol Hill again this morning for the third day of her Senate confirmation hearing. On Tuesday, GOP lawmakers voiced their concerns that she may be too liberal and that, from their perspective, she was too lenient on sex offenders as a district court judge. Texas Senator Ted Cruz said he does not question her character or her concern for children.
But I also see a record of activism and advocacy as it concerns sexual predators that stems back decades and that is concerning.
But Jackson pushed back on that criticism.
In every case, I did my duty to hold the defendants accountable in light of the evidence and the information that was presented to me.
She also vowed that she will not legislate from the bench, but will do her best to interpret the law impartially. At the hearing today, the committee will hear from legal experts before an eventual vote to send her nomination to the Senate floor. Tornadoes tore through parts of Texas and Oklahoma on Tuesday, killing at least one person and wounding more than a dozen. The storm partially tore the roof off of a school and heavily damaged homes and businesses. Scott Haynes is chief of the Jacksboro, Texas Police Department.
We got a lot of work to do. We're a resilient community, and we're gonna bounce back, and everything's gonna be good for us.
The storm continued its destructive path Tuesday into Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee. High winds uprooted trees in Ridgeland, Mississippi, as a possible tornado passed the Jackson City area Tuesday afternoon. The storms also knocked out power to at least 90,000 customers. The storm system pushed into the southeast this morning and is now battering parts of the region with strong winds and heavy rain in several states from Florida to Virginia. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, the push to renew the Iran nuclear deal, plus keeping an old tradition ringing. This is The World and Everything in It. It's Wednesday, March 23rd, 2022. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Mary Reichard. It's time now for Washington Wednesday. Today, reviving the Iran nuclear deal. Former President Trump pulled the plug on the controversial 2015 Iran nuclear deal. But the Biden administration and other world powers are working to revive it. Negotiators recently said that they are close to a deal that supporters say would delay Iran's development of a nuclear weapon. And they argue that there's no time to waste.
The UN's Atomic Watchdog Agency says Iran is now just weeks away from having enough highly enriched uranium for a nuclear bomb. But many analysts question whether a renewed agreement would really accomplish what supporters say it will. Among them is Michael Rubin. He's a former Pentagon official and an expert on Iran who lived in the country after the revolution. He's written and co-written several books on Iranian history.
And he joins us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Reportedly, the last big hang-up here in the nuclear talks is that Iran wants the United States to remove the terrorism designation for Iran's elite Revolutionary Guard. Nobody in Washington is excited about doing that, but there are some who suggest it just might be the lesser of two evils when weighed against the specter of a nuclear Iran. What do you say to that?
Well, the reason why this issue about de-designating the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is so controversial is while in the American press and in the American public mind, the Revolutionary Guard is often associated with its terrorism, there's another side to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. They rose to prominence during the Iran-Iraq War. In 1988, when that war ended, they didn't want to go back to the barracks, and so they started investing in the civilian economy. Without any moral equivalence, what the Revolutionary Guard's economic wing is today, imagine taking the Army Corps of Engineers, merging it with KBR, Halliburton, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Walmart. And so by designating the Revolutionary Guard, what we were also doing is showing not only our European allies, but also China and Russia, that if they were to go into business with this group, they too could be subject to sanctions. And so there's a huge economic question mark and potential windfall over designation or de-designation of this group.
Mm-hmm. Just to give voice to the other side of this argument here, the supporters of reviving the Iran deal, if Iran is as close to a nuclear bomb as the UN says they may be, does it not make sense to at least try to slow down Iran's progress here?
Well, there's two issues here. First of all, the Revolutionary Guard is most involved in the military aspects of that. So if we go back to that previous question about de-designating the Revolutionary Guard, are we actually going to be resourcing the group that has consistently and covertly pushed forward issues such as warhead design, which the revived Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action doesn't actually address? It's mostly an agreement about enrichment. But then there's the broader issue about whether this deal would fundamentally undercut the precedent of nonproliferation. You know, there's been several nonproliferation crises over the decades. When the Soviet Union collapsed, you had the legacy programs in Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus, and we agreed to remove those weapons altogether, actually to the benefit of Russia. Then in South Africa in 1991, they had covertly built six nuclear weapons. They decided to come in from the cold. Nelson Mandela became president in 1994, and it still took 16 additional years for the International Atomic Energy Agency to give them a clean bill of health. When Muammar Gaddafi came in from the cold in 2003, we physically dismantled his program. Now, with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and this revived proposed Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, what we're doing is leaving Iran with more centrifuges than Pakistan had when Pakistan built not a bomb, but its arsenal.
Continuing on with that line of thought, supporters of the Iran nuclear deal and the effort to renew it say that for whatever its flaws, President Trump's maximum pressure campaign was a failure. What's your response to that?
I actually will disagree with this as well. If we want to take a broader picture, when President Barack Obama started negotiating, Iran's economy was in the tank. Iran's GDP had actually declined 5.4% in the year previous to when President Obama started his negotiation. So we had a great deal of leverage. Now, a lot of the criticism with regard to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was it actually allowed Iran to fill up its coffers with hard currency. And we saw a lot of bad Iranian behavior with regard to terrorism, sponsoring regional instability and insurrection and so forth. Now, with regard to President Trump's maximum pressure campaign, we saw Iran's hard currency reserves plummet from more than $100 billion or so down to about $5 billion. I can think of times in Iranian history where maximum pressure did work. At the same time, I can't think of any examples where resourcing an opponent's military actually led to peace.
Well, Michael, you recently wrote an op-ed in which you argued that how we dealt with North Korea shows exactly how another nuclear deal would fail. Elaborate, if you would.
Well, there's a couple different issues with regard to North Korea. One of my criticisms of American policy is that we tend, regardless of administration, to stovepipe. We are negotiating with Iran and we have our blinders on, so we only see Iran. Now, it can be fairly hard to hide an enrichment program simply because you can't dismantle it if the inspectors suddenly knock on the door. But when it comes to other things which we know the Iranians had been involved with in the past, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, for example, warhead design, working with detonators and that sort of issue, which would only have a place in a bomb program, that can be done in a relatively small lab in a small office. What's to stop Iran from doing this in North Korea? When I lived in Tehran, I was at a Persian language school working on my dissertation. There were North Koreans there, and we know that there's been Iranian engineers in North Korea and North Korean witnesses when Iran does its missile launches. And so you have this, if you will, the symbiotic relationship between these two so-called rogue regimes, which this deal does nothing to address. And so I would argue that, simply put, we need to be a little bit more holistic. There's another issue with regard to the North Korea agreed framework, which President Bill Clinton signed in 1994. On one hand, it was meant to eliminate the possibility that North Korea would build nuclear weapons, but we saw that North Korea continued cheating, and today they have nuclear weapons. What evidence do we have that Iran isn't simply trying to follow the North Korea path? At the same time, what we had decided to do back during the Clinton administration is incentivize North Korea with heavy oil shipments, with food, and they had diverted it disproportionately to their military, which, I mean, simply increased the strength of their military relatively. We don't want to get into a situation where we don't see the forest through the trees.
If you had to sum up what you think is the correct answer to keeping a nuclear weapon out of Iran's hands, what would you say to that?
I have no problem negotiating with Iran. I think what we need to do is focus on a way to ensure that any resources that are given to Iran don't fall into the hands of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. At the same time, we are at our best strength as a nation when we act in a bipartisan fashion. The fact that so much of this negotiation has been kept secret even from Congress, the fact that we're not ratifying this as a treaty makes me very, very nervous about its staying power. And that ultimately is, I think, we need to deal with some of the issues on our home front. And honestly, I have more faith in the centrist Republican, centrist Democrats to actually work together to help agree to have a common consensus for a good deal than perhaps some of the Twitterati have and the political pundits on cable talk shows.
Mm-hmm. Final question now, Michael. If all else fails, could you envision the United States, Israel, or any country taking military action to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran?
I can't imagine the United States doing this willingly. Now, and a military action against Iran isn't easy. In 1981, Israel struck at Iraq, and it was a one-off strike on a single target. The same thing repeated back in 2007 in Syria. But Iran is six times the size of the United Kingdom. Even if the Israelis went in with surprise, they couldn't leave with surprise once they dropped their bombs. And so they'd have to take out command and control centers, enemy airfields, and so forth. You're talking at a minimum more than 1,000 sorties. And this is why it's such a mess. Now, the nightmare scenario is that Israel would start something expecting other regional states to clean up the mess if they weren't able to finish it. What I worry about is by pursuing this deal without adequately addressing the concerns of both not only Israel, but some of our Arab allies, we're actually setting a course where they're going to be incentivized to take unilateral action because they don't feel that they can live with the outcome of this deal.
Michael Rubin is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael, we thank you so much.
Thank you.
Additional support comes from Crossway, publisher of Strange New World, How Thinkers and Activists Redefined Identity and Sparked the Sexual Revolution by Carl Truman, crossway.org. And from Heart of Dakota, providing Christ-centered, literature-based homeschool curriculum. Spring sale runs Thursday through Sunday with coupon code SPRING22 at heartofdakota.com.
Well, next up on The World and Everything in It, World Tour, with our reporter in Africa, Onize Ohikere.
We begin today in Afghanistan, where schools are reopening for all students today, and that includes Afghan girls. Girls have been denied education beyond grade 6 since the Taliban swept back into power last August. But global leaders have kept heavy pressure on the new Afghan government. And the Taliban said girls would be allowed to return to classes in all grades beginning this week. Some parents worry for the safety of their daughters and are keeping them at home. But other families say they believe it is safe for girls to return to school. One young student in Kabul, 14-year-old Alina Nazari, said she's excited to return to class. She said, "I am very happy that the schools are reopening for the girls. This year at school might be different from last year because many people have left the country," so many girls might not be able to return to their school. Next, we go to the West African nation of Mali, where family and supporters paid their respects to former Prime Minister Soumaïlou Boubé Maïga. He died on Monday at a clinic in the capital city of Bamako, surrounded by guards. The 67-year-old was being held on suspicion of corruption. But his brother, Tigoum Boubaï Maïga, said the former prime minister was a great man and a great statesman who fought for his beliefs. He said to see members of his brother's political party and the democratic movement paying respects to him, quote, "Yes, it means that he died on the battlefield." Soumaïlou Maïga served as Prime Minister of Mali from 2017 until 2019. He had been detained since August of last year when the country was taken over by a military junta. His health declined, but military rulers denied requests for his medical evacuation. Now, we head to Brussels, where the European Union is ramping up security in face of Russian aggression. The EU's security policy chief, Josep Borrell, announced the approval of a new military strategy called the Strategic Compass. He said by the year 2025, the EU would set up, quote, rapid deployment capacity. It's designed to help the militaries of the European Union to work together to be able to respond more quickly.
It's not about creating a European army. The European armies will remain, each member state having its own military army. But we have to work together closer. We have to coordinate better.
Borrell warned that threats are rising and the cost of inaction is clear. And finally, we travel to Moscow, where the Russian government has sentenced President Vladimir Putin's most high-profile critic to nearly a decade in prison. A court declared Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny guilty of fraud and sentenced him to 9 years in a maximum security prison. Western governments insist it is the Russian government that is guilty of fraud, creating more false charges against Navalny to silence him and send a message to other critics. A judge also ruled that Navalny would have to pay a fine of about $12,000. Russian authorities arrested Navalny when he returned to Russia last year from Germany. He received medical treatment there after surviving an assassination attempt that the West believes the Kremlin ordered. That's it for this week's World Tour. Reporting for World, I'm Onize Ohikere in Abuja, Nigeria.
All right, Comic-Con fans, listen up. The first ever Marvel comic book from 1939 just sold at auction. It features characters like Submariner and the original Human Torch. Now, this particular copy bears the publisher's handwritten notes about what writers and artists got paid. For example, artist Frank Paul earned $25 for drawing the cover. The comic book sold at auction for $2.4 million. Now, that's quite a markup from the original 10-cent price tag on its cover. It's the world and everything in it.
Today is Wednesday, March 23rd. Thank you for turning to World Radio to get your day started. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Paul Butler. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, ringing the bells. There's more than one way to ring the bells. One is called English change ringing. It's a precise art form, and it shows up a lot in British television, like in this 1970s version of The Nine Tailors.
Right, boys? Go.
Trouble's gone, trouble's gone.
This kind of bell ringing was developed in the 17th century, and it's still in practice today. World correspondent Amy Lewis climbed the stairs of a bell tower in Australia to meet a few 21st century bell ringers, keeping the tradition alive.
David Hayes was only 5 years old when he started visiting bell towers with his brother, though it took 10 more years before the bell ringing bug bit him at a convention in Tasmania.
And I saw the interaction with people and things like that, so I decided, right, I'm going to give this a go.
Around the same time, Mary Cowling was in high school when her sister came home from university one day.
My sister, who had gone to the big city of Melbourne to be study, came home one holiday saying, "Mary, we've discovered this fabulous new hobby. You've got to do it." And I said, "What is it?" "It's called bell ringing." The actual magic of the bells was the deep, rich sound. They're very big bells in the town hall, and that depth of sound was just magical.
It was only a matter of time until the two bell ringers met in Melbourne.
In St. Paul's Cathedral Belfry.
Fell in love and got married. While looking for a church, they discovered that St. Paul's Anglican Church in Geelong was restoring its bells. The bells had been silent for 100 years. David and Mary jumped in to help and have been at the church ever since. St. Paul's square brick tower rises over the busiest street in Geelong. It's the only church in town that does English change ringing. Each bell is attached to a large wheel and balances with its mouth pointing up. Bell ringers pull a rope attached to the bell's wheel to make it spin one rotation. That makes the clapper strike when the bell is almost 3/4 of the way around.
We have a single octave. I think we're in the key of F major. And the highest bell, the smallest one, is called the treble. And we always start ringing the highest bell to the lowest. So this runs down an octave.
But that can get monotonous after a few rounds. So bell ringers in the early 1600s developed a method to ring different patterns.
And then we start mixing the
change the order.
We change the order according to certain mathematical
principles,
yes. We have method names. So you probably have heard Granser from the Nine Tailors, that Dorothy says the Nine Tailors.
The methods are full of permutations, algorithms, and Hamiltonian cycles. Think of each bell as a traveling salesman who goes in a certain pattern to each of his cities exactly once. He never retraces a path, but he ends up where he began.
Mathematicians love it.
Our son is one of them. His life is computers, and he has a brain that just laps up all these numbers and these methods and things.
With a tenor bell the size of a VW bug and the treble bell the size of an upright piano, it's tricky to change the timing.
And then where I am is to keep everything strictly mechanically one after the other, and that's the skill.
But skill isn't all that's needed. Having 8 bells means needing 8 bell ringers.
We go through cycles where we have enough and enough to ring all 8 plus a few extras. And then, like last year, the year before, two of our members died. 2 became too frail to ring.
Some move away, going to universities.
Yes, all of that. And we're at the point now of struggling to get a team.
But when you have a team, there's nothing quite like it.
Look, dude. This is going too well. We'll stop.
Trevor's going. He's gone.
The best part is when you've got a good team around you, you're ringing a method that challenges you without extending you so you're stressed and worried, and the rhythm is going and you're just engrossed. You're just in another world. You're making magnificent sound, and it's just so elevating. But the community is a good thing too.
The relational side of bell ringing is on clear display this Sunday afternoon. Bell ringers from 3 different towns arrive for a practice session.
David, is Mary coming?
No, she's
not well.
Oh, really? She's
going
to come, but she's...
Apologies.
She's
sure.
Big locals are probably late.
So we should...
do Stedman doubles, and that's what he'd attract.
They wear flip-flops and moccasins, dress shoes, hiking boots and tennis shoes. They're different ages and come from different walks of life. Mary is out sick this afternoon, but Helen from Melbourne brings her a homemade jar of jam. A bell ringer from Ballarat asks after David's health. They care for one another, even though they usually ring in different towers. When COVID restrictions limited how many people could be in the small bell tower, the bell still rang.
David came over every day for 9 months, every day, and just rang our biggest bell as a kind of symbol to the community that we're still here and we're still trying to outreach people. Right. Remember the man who was stuck here from overseas? He just, every morning when he was at work, hearing this bell toll just made him feel a connection with his home, his church, and his family.
The purpose of the bells hasn't changed for all these hundreds of years.
To call people to worship is the short answer.
Of course, in the early days, the bells were sending messages to people out in the fields and things, and giving them indications of the times of day and all of those things.
When to pray.
In the words of the hymn writer, "Glad bells ring loud and clear. The Lord our God is here. We will adore with humble hearts aflame. And everyone proclaim with voice or bell his name forevermore." Reporting for World, I'm Amy Lewis in Geelong, Victoria, Australia.
Today is Wednesday, March 23rd. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Up next, World founder Joel Bells contemplates the big news behind the news.
In a recent dream, I was editor-in-chief of a daily newspaper. 4,000 years ago in Cairo, Egypt. I dream a lot, but rarely this far back into history. But even if you're just a casual student of history or of the Bible, you might appreciate what was going on. My wife Carol and I had been reading through the Old Testament book of Exodus. We'd also been thinking a lot about the gifted people who have so regularly and faithfully come to our various publications and platforms, people being journalized by the World News Group. Maybe it was that combination that launched my dream. It intrigues me to think how we might have covered an event like the Egyptian plagues. Who would be on my dream team of journalists? It should include both generalists and specialists. Suppose, for the time being, that we're sitting at my desk as the editor-in-chief in Cairo at the time of the Exodus plagues. How do we begin building our staff? We should probably start with the big story, the frog story. Who knows the world's top expert on frogs? Has this happened in other countries? Have so many calamities happened simultaneously in just one culture? Do we have to send our staff there to be briefed, or can we bring them here? I'll tell you, though, what really bothers me. There are enough facets to this one story, that's the story of the frogs, that it could take our whole staff to do it well. It's a big deal, a very big deal. Yet at the very same time, there are a dozen other equally important stories. The Bible, of course, lists 10 distinct plagues. There are similar things happening with atmosphere-related issues like the Nile River turning to blood or daylight turning to pitch dark. There are also big but unpredictable things happening to animals as different as insects and livestock. Every one of these developments calls on a reporting team 10 times as big as the one I've got. Who is more important to our assignment? A generalist who is both smart and wise about everything in all these various fields of expertise, or a series of specialists? But we may ultimately find that the most glaringly missing piece from this human puzzle is not just one more story or picture, but is instead the infallible explanation of everything that is already there by the one who created it all in the first place. The whole purpose of the plagues was to drive at least two nations to that God, each in its own way. For the Egyptians, it was to be a first-time face-to-face acquaintance. For the people of Israel, it was to be a humbling return. It's still tempting to try to explain all the details of human events as they unfold. Too often, though, our sophisticated efforts simply make the problem harder. The only thing that glues these various plagues together is the power that is behind them. And the more I hear about them, the more I am reminded that that power is actually a superpower, whose judgments are just and whose mercies are more, who wants us to know and love him personally and to worship him. That was true 4,000 years ago. It's still true today. I'm Joel Bells.
Tomorrow, some people who recover from COVID don't recover their sense of smell. We'll have a report. And we'll learn a little bit about the most watched sporting event across the globe, the quadrennial World Cup. That and more tomorrow. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The Bible says the Lord satisfies the longing soul, and the hungry soul he fills with good things. Go now in grace and peace.